Welcome to the Wealth Matters Podcast, where investors come together to better understand how to build passive cash flow and create generational wealth without all the confusing mumbo-jumbo. Here's your host and co-author of Amazon number one bestseller, Alpesh Pamar.
Welcome to Wealth Matters Podcast. I'm going to talk to someone who is a really famous CPA in the bigger pockets world. Everyone knows Thomas and Brandon Hall, who is his partner. So Thomas Castelli is a tax strategist and real estate investor himself, who helps other real estate investors keep more of their hard-earned dollars in their pockets and out of the government's or Sam Uncle's pockets. So welcome, Thomas.
Thank you for having me, Alpesh. It's a pleasure to be here.
Absolutely. And I don't know, Thomas, if you noticed, but I'm wearing the Tax Smart Investors hat today.
Oh, no, I love it. Looks really good on you. Looks really good on you.
Thank you. So we start with this question with every guest. Tell us something interesting or funny about yourself.
That's a good one. I was actually thinking about this before the show. You know, something fairly interesting. It's a tough one. So, you know, one thing that's really interesting is I'm a big workout buff. Like, I love working out.
Oh,
like,
man, you and I are going to have fun today.
And I think a lot of people wouldn't expect that. So, fitness is probably something that I hold very dear to me. It's a very important part of my life, you know, right next to working and helping people save tax. So,
that's great. So I have the same exact thing. I think fitness is the most important thing for me, and I consider it's a trifecta, right? And when I say trifecta, it's like physical health, mental health, and financial health.
Absolutely.
You can't have one or the two and be able to enjoy your life, right?
Right,
so
right.
You've got to have all three of them.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, health is one of the most important things. They say, you know, health is wealth. If you don't have your health, then what else do you have? So, I was just at the gym this morning, actually, and one of the personal trainers was like, hey, if you want to stay young, you're in the right place. You know, he's like, you're in the gym, right? That's where people stay young. So,
that's great, man. So, and of course, you are a CPA.
Yes.
And we all know that you are pretty famous CPA. You do great work, but you also invest in real estate.
Yes.
What was your first investment and how did it work out for you?
Yeah, so my first investment was back almost 10 years ago now, actually. And it was as a limited partner. It was in a, I think it was, if I remember correctly, I think it was 32 units. I think it was a 32 unit apartment complex in Columbus, Ohio. And it was like a C plus property. And the deal was go in there, renovate all the units, push up the net operating income and, exit. And, this happened to be because it was so far back in the cycle. This investment did pretty well. And,
you
know, as a limited partner, I did get to see like the inner workings of the deal. So it was really exciting.
Oh, that's great. So what kind of real estate do you invest in now?
So right now, the type of real estate I'm currently investing in, I'm in a multifamily fund. So I have some exposure to multifamily. Then I'm in, also in an industrial fund. Right now, I like the triple net space. So,
yes.
Got some industrial, and then I'm also actually in a car wash fund. So it's not really real estate, but kind of, because the fund owns the real estate and the car washes. So, those are the commercial, I guess you could say I'm in commercial and multifamily.
Right. So, and I almost know which industrial fund and car wash fund you'll be in, but we don't need to discuss that here. So you mentioned one thing that your first investment, you invested as a limited partner.
Right.
And as a limited partner, I always talk about the depreciation and a lot of time. Limited partners are basically passive investors, right?
Right.
So what are the limitations for passive investors when taking advantage of depreciation?
Right. So for everybody listening, if you're not sure what depreciation is, basically it's a non-cash expense on your profit and loss statement. And when you own real estate, thanks to something known as bonus depreciation, your depreciation expense could be quite large. And when you're a passive investor, what ends up happening is Well, let me back up for a second. The depreciation often causes the property to operate at a large tax loss, despite the fact you might have actually generated positive cash flow.
It's a phantom loss. Yeah.
Yes, it only exists on paper. And the problem is with passive investments, right? Or if you're a passive investor, right? The losses from your real estate are kind of trapped in this bucket called this passive bucket. And it can only, generally speaking, only offset other passive income you might have. So in other words, it generally is not going to offset your W-2 or active trader business income that you might have from a job, from a business that you're running. So that's kind of the limitation when investing passively. The losses that are generated by depreciation get stuck in this passive bucket.
Right. So, and I know once it's stuck, it's not easy to, you know, take advantage of it, and you just have to carry forward the depreciation on on your tax return. But there is one way, which you and I know really well, of course you do, that they can use that depreciation to their advantage, and that is they can be a real estate professional or REP status, right?
Right. Right.
If they cannot be a real estate professional because they already have a W-2 job, because they don't, you know, they are totally limited in their investment, right? They are limited partner or passive investors. Is there any other way?
Is there any other way? Yes, there actually is. There's something what's kind of been termed as the short-term rental loophole. And that's an exception. So very interesting thing about the short-term rental loophole is, so we have to kind of give the story a little bit about how this all came together. So way back in 1986, right, there was a Tax Reform Act of 1986 that was passed, and it introduced Section 469, which is the passive activity rules, and it made all rental activities passive by default, right? So, and then it had trader businesses, right? So trades or businesses are passive if you don't materially participate, and they are non-passive if you do materially participate. Right. However, rental activities doesn't matter if you materially participate or not. They are passive unless you can qualify as a real estate professional. However, there is a section of the tax code that has exceptions to the definition of rental activity. And under that section, there's a handful of exceptions, but there's two specific exceptions that are highly relevant to owners of short-term rental properties. And that is if you have if the average period of customer use is 7 days or less, or if the average period of customer use is 30 days or less, and you provide substantial services for the convenience of your guests. And substantial services are typically services that you would find in a hotel. So like daily cleaning, daily meals, vouchers, concierge services, transportation, those types of things. So if you meet one of those two criteria, then your rental activity, right, your short-term rental is no longer a rental activity for the purposes of Section 469. It just gets moved into the trader business bucket. And trades or businesses, if you do materially participate, they will be non-passive, and you don't have to qualify as a real estate professional because it's not a rental activity anymore. So that's really what makes short-term rentals so powerful from a tax perspective, is that you can buy a piece of real estate, and if you rent it out, average stay of 7 days or less, which is the most common exception, then all you have to do is meet one of three tests, which I could kind of get into in a little bit more detail, and yes, the losses will be non-passive. So that's the power of short-term rentals.
So let me make sure. Short-term rental is, we are referring to properties which are operating similar to hotel, right? Like Airbnbs, or if you have it on VRBO, etc., right? And breakfast kind of deal. Why short-term rental? Does it make sense to invest in short-term rental right now?
Yeah, so that's actually a really good question. So it definitely depends on your location. I think that's the most important factor in short-term rentals, because, you know, generally speaking, you will be more profitable with a short-term rental than you would be with a long-term rental if you invest in the right place. The biggest risk of investing in short-term rentals is local regulation, right? So there's a lot of like vacation communities and vacation destinations out there that either already went through the regulation phase or aren't going to regulate short-term rentals heavily because their local economy depends so heavily on tourism and people coming there and staying. So many times those markets, generally speaking, are safer. But then you have like your normal markets, someone where like, you know, your normal neighborhood where they will, where a lot of like counties and like local governments are starting to regulate Airbnbs and say, okay, you can't rent for less than a certain period of time because they don't want their neighborhoods, they don't want the people, like their communities where people are living in as a residence to be disrupted by Airbnbs. So I guess to answer your question, the one thing I've realized in real estate, the one thing I've been told a lot and kind of really made an epiphany for me is it's not when you should invest in real estate, it's where you should invest in real estate. And I think that that rings very true for short-term rentals. So is now a good time to invest in short-term rentals? If you could find properties that cash flow, you know, even with interest rates being where they are, you know, absolutely. It's just a matter, again, like I said, knowing the location and the potential, you know, making sure that you're not getting, you're not buying a property that could potentially be regulated, right? And right. And blow the short-term rental situation for you.
Yeah, and one of the wise mentor told me once that in real estate, there are only three rules, location, location, and location, right?
Right. So right.
That's the key. So of course, we will now get to the meat of the podcast, right? The short-term rental loophole and how you can qualify for it. But just taking my example, and of course, I'm a real estate professional status, but if I was not, how would it work? Especially, I live in the San Francisco Bay Area. I don't invest in California because of the tenant-friendly laws already. And the prices have skyrocketed. So for me, let's say if I can't buy a short-term rental within an hour drive of mine, maybe I drive, you know, I buy it somewhere in Lake Tahoe, which is about 4 hours drive, or maybe in another state, would I be even able to use as a short-term rental loophole because there is no easy way for me to meet the criteria?
Yeah, so you can app. There are absolutely ways to do it. So let me start here. So there are seven material participation tests you can meet, right? Out of those seven, there are three that really matter. One of them is that you spend more than 500 hours on the property. Okay. Most people who invest in short-term rentals aren't going to be using that, just in my experience. Another one is you do substantially all. So if you're, meaning you do almost everything for the activity. So if you're investing remotely, that test is going to be out. But now there's another test, and this test works really well with remote properties, is you spend more than 100 hours on the activity and no one other individual spends more time than you. So what this allows you to do is it allows you to buy a property that's in another state or a few hours away, whatever the case is. And then you can act as like, you act as the property manager, the coordinator, you make everything go, if you will. But you can use the help of cleaners, you can use the help of handymen to come in and do repairs and maintenance on the property. And as long as no one of those other people spends more time than you, and you're spending more than 100 hours, you can use that material participation test. So it kind of, to answer the question, yes, you can invest remotely, and you can absolutely do that. That's the test you're going to have to use. And, you know, even with the systems you can set up, there's still a lot of back and forth with tenants that's going to take up a lot of time. There's going to be, you're planning the repairs and maintenance and furnishing the property, getting it listed, renting it out, and kind of just doing all the like work that it takes to get a short-term rental up and running, and then actually continuing to run it as like the property manager. That's how you'd be able to meet that test and do it remotely. We see people do it all the time.
I see. So one is you got to spend over 500 hours on
right.
the property. And if I have three properties, do I combine all the hours to 500 or does it have to be 1500 hours now?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So normally, yes, you'd have to materially participate, meet one of the tests on each property. However, there's an election. There's a grouping election. It's under section... Yes. It's under regulation section 1.469-4 that allows you to group similar businesses. They call it an appropriate economic unit if certain criteria are met. And there's about five criteria that they look at very heavily to determine do you meet it. And it's similarities or differences between the businesses, right? So if you have multiple short-term rentals, similar businesses, you're going to probably check that box. Common control. So like, you know, do you have the management rights and ability to make decisions effectively on those properties. And like, that's kind of what that means in a nutshell. Common ownership. So is there common ownership structures? Do you have ownership over these properties? Yeah. So most people will meet those three, especially if they're investing, by themselves.
Right.
And then the next one is geographic location. So if you have short-term rentals all in one area, you're going to meet that criteria. And then the fifth one is interdependencies in between the economic units. Most short-term rentals are not going to meet that because there's just no need for it, but you don't need to meet all five of them. You just need to meet a handful. There's no definition of, okay, you need to meet three out of five or two out of five. Those are just the ones that they look at the most heavily. And if you meet some of those, you check those boxes, then you can group them all together. And then you only have to meet the test across, not just on one property. You could do it across all of your properties. You group them in together as one unit for the purposes of those material participation tests.
Oh, that's interesting. Now that makes sense. So that is the 500 hours. And the other one you mentioned was that you got to spend more time than anyone else on the property. So let's say if I hired one cleaner, right? And he or she comes with other people, like two people, and does this for, every week, maybe spends 3 hours on my property. That's already going to be more than 100 hours. So do I need to make sure that someone else shows up like every other week or something like that? Because how do you make that work?
Yeah, that's a great question. There's been multiple ways we've heard people figure this out. Sometimes it's you working, it depends on like where you're located and what type of vendors are around. But you could either have hire different cleaners to come clean, you could cycle them through, or you hire a cleaning company and just make sure that cleaning company cycles through the cleaners so that not one individual is ever taking up more hours. So that's kind of the way you'd have to do it. You'd have to work with a cleaning company effectively that has multiple cleaners and just make sure that the same one isn't coming to your house all the time so that they're not spending more time than you.
That means that there are a lot of similar to real estate professional status where we have to, capture the number of hours spent and all you have done. So same way in this case, also, you got to have documents. You got to record everything.
Right, right.
What, do you have any idea on how one should document, how one should create maybe systems or processes around this?
Yeah. So to be able to prove this, you need to have, if you're going to need to have a time log of, generally speaking, a time log is the best form of substantiation to prove the amount of hours that you spent. Now, that's kind of the first step. So you can use a spreadsheet for that. A lot of people just use an Excel spreadsheet, track their time there. Some people use applications, time tracking applications for that. I know there's one of them that's really good is Toggle is one of them. I know some people use, but there's Clockify. There's a bunch of them out there that people have used, but that's one way to track your time. Now you're also going to need to track other people's time. So if you're going to use that 100 hour test, right? If you're not using the 100 hour test, you don't really need to track other people's time. But if you are, now how people do that, we've seen some really interesting ways. The two best ways I think I've heard are some people will record it on their, like they'll have like a Ring camera, right? And they'll record when someone enters and when someone leaves, and they'll be able to see the time in between. Okay. So, if the cleaner comes at 1:45 and they leave at 2:45, just for example, that cleaner spent an hour. Other people have lock boxes on their properties. So the cleaner will come, they'll open a lock box and they'll have a record of what time that lock box was opened. And then when the cleaner leaves, they'll close the lock box and they'll have a record of when they left. So those are the two most innovative methods that I've heard of. Other people will try to have their cleaners like just give them a time log of the amount of time they spent. That sometimes we hear a lot of pushback on, like it's just hard to get the cleaners or hard to get the companies to actually provide that type of information, which is why I think the lock box and the camera system has been the most popular, because you don't need to pester, if you will, or try to chase down the cleaners to get the amount of time they spent.
Right. So, and you mentioned short-term rental, right? So someone basically weekly or something less than 30 days. So of course, as real estate investors, we know long-term rentals where the tenant signs lease and stays there for 6 months or a year, and the short-term rental. But there is something in between also called mid-term rentals,
Right,
which are
midterm rentals.
gaining popularity. Can someone have mid-term rental and also be able to take advantage of STR loophole, or there is no way?
Generally, no. And I'm gonna, and so underneath the tax code, there's no such thing as like a midterm rental. There's no,
Right.
there's either you have a short term, it's either you have a property that has like 7 days or less, or 30 days or less if you're providing the substantial services. And if you don't meet those criteria and you're not providing these big
Okay.
services, then it's considered a long-term rental, and it's a rental activity. And like we mentioned before, unless you qualify as a real estate professional, it's going to be passive. So now, how can this be done? I mean, you have it's a big math equation, right? Because you'd have to end up renting it out for less than 7 days. Like, say for
Yes.
example, you rented out a property one day for one time for 30 days, right? And you didn't provide substantial services. Well, it's the average period a customer uses, 7 days. So you'd have to whip out an Excel spreadsheet and start doing calculations. Well, how many stays do you need to have less than 7 days to make the average go down to seven or below? And it's theoretically possible, but I've not seen anybody actually pull it off in practice. I think in a rare, I think in one circumstances, one of our advisors found a client that had like just below, but like it was more of happenstance than it was planned. Like, it just kind of happened. So I guess to answer your question, theoretically possible, yes. Practical, probably not, in most cases.
Yeah, and the reason I ask is that, as you mentioned, a lot of cities are changing, right? And counties, they are changing regulations to
Yeah.
not allow short-term rental. And I know people who bought into short-term rental mania in last couple of years. Now they are converting it to mid-term rentals, where they are, going to cater to traveling nurses and whatnot, right? So it's fully furnished still, and pretty much will generate similar income, not at the same scale, but at least you don't have a lot of people in and out every, week or every other day, right? So that was the reason I asked. My other question is, let's say someone is qualifies for real estate professional status.
Right.
Is it worth for them to have a short-term rental?
It depends, right? Because if you qualify as a real estate professional, your long-term rentals will be non-passive, right? But the short it does not help with your short-term rentals, because short-term rentals are in a separate bucket. So will
Yeah,
it
I was
help?
going there.
I think it depends, because what's going to end up happening is you would need to meet the short-term rental criteria, right? Even if you are a real estate professional. So it depends on your strategy. I if your goal is to reduce taxes, then no, it's not going to necessarily help. But if you want to own short-term rental properties because they happen to be more profitable, and you can meet the exceptions that we discussed, then it can absolutely help. But like, I'm just speaking for my own self. If I was a real estate professional and I was buying long-term rental properties, I would, and my goal was re to reduce taxes, I wouldn't buy a short-term rental, right? Just because I already have that ability with the long-term rentals and the business that I'm already in. Having said that, though, if I was a real estate professional, I said, you know what, I want short-term rentals because they're more profitable maybe than my long-term rentals. Well, that's a whole nother story. And so I guess it just really depends on your investment strategy and, really what you're looking to do. But to help reduce taxes, if that's the goal, I say it's kind of a bit redundant. Definitely.
And that's where I was going. Is it worth? Because you'll have to qualify. What I was trying to figure out, can I put short-term rental into my active investment because I'm already a real estate professional? But if that is not possible, then it's
Yeah.
definitely redundant.
Yeah, because what happens is, and there's tax court cases on this, and basically, because it's not a rental activity, you can't group it in with your long-term rentals. And it's just, and because it's not a rental activity, even if you like, the bottom line is that it's its own little separate island. And you need to qual you can't group it in with the rentals you already have. So you'd have to qualify for the criteria separately on the short-term rental. Oh, I think you went mute.
Sorry. The other question I had was, Can you share an example? Because we spoke about short-term rental loophole, but of course, I think it would help my listeners to see some numbers. So if you don't have to, mention client or something, but if you can share some example or numbers on how much the tax savings would have been or had been if they have chosen short-term rental, or if you saw some, tax savings as well already with your clients, that would be helpful.
Okay, so I'll just give I'll give it I'll give it I'll give an example here of how it generally works, right? I think that'd probably be the best visualization, right? So let's say that you had a property is $500,000, right? Kind of right down the middle of the road. Usually, anywhere between 20 to 30% of that property is going to be eligible for bonus depreciation. So let's just say 20%. Let's just be conservative here, just because the numbers are still going to be pretty good, right? So 20%, that's going to mean $100,000 of that $500,000 would be eligible for bonus depreciation. Now we're going to go ahead and say, well, bonus depreciation in 2023 is at 80%. So we're going to multiply that $100,000 by 80%, and we're going to get $80,000. That means that you're going to get the your depreciation expense from bonus depreciation is going to be $80,000. Now you have a little bit more depreciation from the portion that's not 100% bonus, but let's just say this $80,000, you combine it with your expenses, and maybe your total loss ends up being, let's say, 86,000, right? Because that's realistic. It's a number that we see all the time. Like, it's a common number, right? Let's say that it's 86,000 and you're at the 37% tax bracket, let's just assume. Well, that's $31,820 in tax savings, which is pretty substantial. Now, let's say you bought $1 million property, right? Let's just say you took it up a notch. You kind of applied the same principles, 20%. That's 200,000. Then all of a sudden you get 80% bonus depreciation. You put $160,000 deduction from depreciation, and at 37% tax bracket, that's worth $59,200 to you. And if you look at going and purchasing another property, right? Let's just say you're able to get, let's just call it, let's be conservative again. Let's go with a 65% loan to value ratio, right? Even though you might be able to get higher, that's going to be worth, I do the math right there. Yeah, I did. Okay. So it's going to be, I was looking at him like, okay, but 91,000, like, that can't be right. No, it is right. Okay. 91,700, excuse me, $91,076 in additional purchasing power that you maybe didn't have before. So that's kind of the power of the short-term rental loophole, is you're able to save significant amounts in taxes, sometimes, usually anywhere between five. And depending on how much property you buy, I've seen people push it to six figures, but definitely in the mid to high five figure range is definitely very possible to save in taxes. And you could take that money, reinvest it into your rental business if you wanted to, and continue to grow your wealth rather than pay the government, right? So it's kind of the power of the strategy.
So now, no, thank you so much for explaining. It leads me to a couple of questions. One, so in commercial world, we do cost segregation, right, to get this bonus depreciation amount. And in long-term rentals, we don't usually do it because it's not usually worth it. But you suggested in short-term rental, most of the people do it because that is when you will see the benefit, right? Because in long-term rental, most of the time, the cost is like 2 to 3 grand, and you are not going to see much. So in short-term rental, why would bonus depreciation produce so much more depreciation? Is it because it's fully furnished and you have a lot more?
Well, it's not so much that the short-term rental produces more bonus depreciation. Generally speaking, it's a long-term rental compared to a short-term rental wouldn't, if it's the same property, wouldn't produce, if it's the same exact property, wouldn't produce any more bonus depreciation. They would both produce the same amount.
Oh, okay.
It's what it comes down to is the loss that the depreciation generates.
Ah.
That loss, because if you use the short-term rental like loophole, for example, because it's non-passive, it can offset your active income. That's where the real power comes in. Whereas if it was a long-term rental and you don't qualify as a real estate professional, well, then at that point, that loss will be passive, and it will only be able to offset your passive income. And if you don't have any passive income, it'll get carried forward, and it's not going to offset your W-2 income or income from an active trader business that you're running. So really, it's sum it up there. It's not so much that you get more bonus depreciation. It's just your ability to use the losses that are generated via that bonus depreciation to offset your active income is really why it's so much more powerful for short-term rentals.
No, that I totally forgot about that. So the last question I have, or maybe more, is that this strategy is and real estate professional strategy, they are dependent on bonus depreciation. And if
right.
I understand, bonus depreciation is being phased out every year by 20%. Last year it was 100%, if I'm correct. This year is 80, then
right.
I think 60, 40, and 20, right?
Right.
So would this become a problem in 3-4 years? I don't. It may not be worthwhile.
Yeah. So that's a great question. So there's a little bit to unpack there. So yeah, you're right. Absolutely, it's going to phase out 20% each year until it's gone in 2027. That's what's happening now. As for it causing a problem, there's a good chance that these strategies will still be beneficial even without bonus depreciation, because what happens is when you do a cost segregation study, you're breaking down the components of the property from, say, 39-year class life or 27.5-year class life into 5, 15, and 27, or 5, 15, and 39. Mm-hmm. So that 5 and 15-year property is still getting accelerated. You're still depreciating it much faster than you would the entire property over 39 years, right? Or 27.5 years. So there will still be benefit, but you know, I'll say it's definitely not going to be as high. And the thing that a lot of people are banking on or hoping on is that that some type of legislation will come
right.
out. And either many people don't believe that they're going to extend bonus depreciation per se at like 100%, but they think that they'll put it at like 50% and it'll just remain at 50%, because before the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, bonus depreciation was at 50% for a while. So a lot of people think they'll go back to that. But having said that, there's no guarantees that's going to happen. So the best thing people could do today is take advantage of this strategy now while it's here, because you just don't know what the future is going
to
bring.
Right. So not to be political here, but maybe Trump comes back into power.
Yeah, I mean, I think if that happened, you'd see something like that happen. That would be the best bet, but we don't know. But we don't know.
Yes. So now another question I had about depreciation is the recapture. How would
right.
that work in this case?
Yeah. So the recapture. So right when you sell a property, you're going to have a capital gain. The best way I could probably do this is an example, right? Let's say you buy $1 million property and you take I'm going to do the math again on here. You do the cost seg, and let's just say you took the $200,000 of depreciation, right? Just
right.
for the sake of illustration. Well, now you're going to have, so your cost basis when you bought the property is going to be $1 million, right? More or less. There'll be some other adjustments, but it's $1 million, let's say. And then you take this $200,000 of depreciation. Now your adjusted basis is $800,000. So if we were to go and sell this property, say a year down the line for $1.2 million, and now you don't have a $200,000 gain, right? You don't have, it's not $1.2 million less $1 million. It's $1.2 million less $800,000. So now you have a $200,000 capital gain, and you have $200,000 from depreciation recapture.
Right.
So that's kind of how it works from a visual component of it. Now, you would have to pay tax on the depreciation recapture, but there's a few reasons why people would do this, right? Well, one way to kind of mitigate your exposure or defer your exposure to depreciation recapture is to use a 1031 exchange. So if you exit the property using a 1031 exchange, generally speaking, you're able to kick the can down the road
right.
with the depreciation recapture, with the capital gain, kind of mitigating your exposure. Another way to do that, another way to look at it, would be if you're able to save money today, right?
Yeah.
And you're able to invest that money today, you can earn a return on your money, and you'll have more money today than you would in the future,
right.
Rather than just paying that money to the IRS. So the time value of money, is the real reason why people are doing this. And the
right.
example I always give, just to kind of give an example, right? Let's just say you were able to save $100,000 in taxes using these strategies.
Right.
Well, if you were to invest if you were to invest that $100,000 at an 8% return, and we all know 8% is pretty low for real estate, even in these times. But like, if you're able to do that in 10 years, you're going to have $215,000. And that's $115,000 that you didn't have had you just paid the government. So a lot of times people get worried about depreciation recapture. Oh, I'm eventually going to have to pay it back. So what's the point of taking it? Well, kind of the first thing is you have to take depreciation. There's no really way around it. They make you take it. But also, when you look at the time value of money, your ability to take that, the tax savings, and reinvest it and earn a return. And then B, you look at your ability to mitigate your exposure to the depreciation recapture via strategies like 1031. It kind of makes a lot of sense to do it.
No, I totally agree. Because remember, dollar is losing its value every day, right? So that's another thing. The money you have right now is more valuable than the money you are going to spend in after 5 years, right? That 100,000 is worth way more right now. So, you know, definitely take advantage of it.
Absolutely. That's the entire reason to use these strategies we're talking about.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Thomas, for your time. I really enjoyed. Are you ready for fire round?
I'm ready. Let's go.
Would you be changing any business or investment strategy because of inflation or recession?
Because of inflation, recession, I got to tell you, I already did. So I have to just be honest, right? So multifamily, love multifamily, been investing in multifamily for years. Got me a little bit on the wary side about it. Yes. So I went ahead and I invested in some industrial triple net. That's because triple net, like, you're locking in the lease for 20 years, yeah, something like, you know, along those lines. And they're backed by a very credit stable company. So I did change my strategy, but I'd say I tilted it. I didn't completely change it. So
no, and car wash as well, right? So you got to, change. Favorite investment, real estate, or business book?
Great. That's tough. So I was thinking about this question before the show. Can I give two? If possible, I'll give two.
Yeah.
So I'll give one general business book. I can't say I have a favorite book, but general business book is going to be The Essays of Warren Buffett. I think it's probably one of the best business and investment books that I've probably ever read. But then specifically with real estate, you know, I really, because I do invest in syndicates and funds, is The Hands-Off Investor by Brian Burke. It was actually phenomenal book. I never read a book better on that subject. So that's probably my favorite real estate investment book.
Thank you. Any tool or website you recommend or you cannot live without?
Any web tool or website? Yahoo Finance. I don't know. I love Yahoo Finance. I can't live without that website.
Any advice for beginner investors?
Yeah. So I would say the advice I'm about to give might be somewhat contradictory, but it makes sense. So there's kind of two parts to it, right? You want to make sure that you have the right investment strategy for your long-term investment goals, right? So you want to spend some time in the beginning really learning about the different strategies out there and making sure that you pick the right one for you. But then you need to start taking action, right? So you don't want to be too much in that phase of what should I do for a long time. You need to kind of sort that out. And then once you sort that out, you commit to that strategy and then go ahead and execute that strategy. Because one of the things I did early on in my investment journey was spent too much time in, they call it analysis paralysis, right? Like trying to figure out what the right direction to go in is. So you definitely want to figure that out, but then you want to take action, because otherwise, if you don't take action, you'll never invest and you'll never be able to make any money, right? So, and build the wealth. So that's kind of my advice to beginner. Step one, figure out your strategy. But then once you figure out your strategy, get to it and start taking action. Now you're on mute.
How do you give back?
How do I give back? Right now I'm doing a lot of like free continuing professional education for CPAs out there. There's like a lot of, I'm just educating them on these various strategies and how to help them help their clients. So that's kind of how I'm giving back at the moment. But I do plan in the not too distant future to start kind of getting involved with helping the education of children on financial like literacy and business. I think if children learn this stuff at an early age, it's going to set them up for a lot of success in the future.
That's awesome. How can my listeners reach out to you?
Yeah, so probably the best way to get in contact with me would probably be on Facebook. We do have a Facebook group. It's taxsmartinvestors.com/groups. Excuse me. It's www.facebook.com/group/tax1investors. Probably the best way to get in contact with me is probably through that group.
It's awesome. Thank you so much, Thomas, for your time today.
Thank you for having me. It's been fun.
Thanks for listening to the Wealth Matters podcast. If you enjoyed it, please leave us a 5-star rating on iTunes so others can enjoy the show too. Have a great week and happy investing.